With us this afternoon for a speaker, one of our young men that's been called of God to speak. And I feel that when this has been brought before us, that we should give our careful and prayerful attention to the words that he gives us, Brother Ryan McIndrew.
Thank you, Jim. On the way up to reunion this year, I had my son and one of his friends, one of Jay's sons, in the car with me, and we were about 40 miles out of town, and we decided they needed to know a little bit about what was going on here at reunion. They started asking how many days they were going to be here, and how many services were going to be each day, and how long the services were going to last, so we explained it all to them, and they kind of acted like they could bear it. And this morning, my son, about every hour, he'd ask me how much longer, and then by the last hour, it was every 5 minutes he'd ask me how many more minutes it was going to be, and just went on and went on. And this afternoon, I've had people ask me if it's going to be a one or two pillow service, and showing me they're keeping an eye on their watch and stuff. It reminded me of a story that I had recently read. There was this young boy and his father were walking down the street going to church, and there was a big church in a military town. And they were passing by the wall of the church. There was a plaque on the wall. The little boy looked at the plaque, and he wasn't old enough to read, and he asked his dad, he said, "Dad, what is this on the wall here?" And his dad says, "Well, son, that's a plaque in memory of all the brave men that died in the service." The little boy looks a little puzzled and says, "Well, Dad, was it the morning or evening service?" Well, we all know the real killer is the afternoon service. So, we will do it the best we can, and I'll keep it as short as I can, but I do think I have a message for you today. So we'll go on. We're going to start this morning in Isaiah 40th chapter. Starting at the 28th verse. It says, "Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard? That the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding. Now, right here in this verse, it probably goes on to explain God and his functions more than any other place, or as well as any other place. At the very beginning, well, before that, let me say the Bible was written for intelligent people. People that can see and understand that for every design, there has to be a designer. Things don't just do themselves. So the Bible starts out says, in the beginning, God. No explanation. No explanation about God. It's an assumption. God, you intelligent people, realize God. He is there. He already exists. You know that. The fact that the Bible was written, there was a God. When you write a letter to somebody, you don't spend the first paragraph trying to justify the fact that you exist. The fact that you wrote the letter indicates that you are there. And that's where the Bible is written, that you, that God exists. And the verse goes on to tell us. That he fainteth not. He's forever. He has no beginning. He has no end. He's the creator of all things. He's the designer, the sculptor. He's the ultimate source of strength. So magnificent, the mortal man is not able to understand this amount of strength that God has. That because you're here today, I think you already know that. You believe in God. So how will that aid us today? How will that help us? Let's read verse 29 and 30. He giveth power to the faint, and those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. Now Isaiah here, written about 700 years before Christ, is speaking about something that is in today, probably more than any ever time before. It talks about the young men will be faint and weary. And he used young men to depict the strongest among the people. Those that were strong, those that were strength, those that the people depended upon would grow faint and they would grow weary. It was a matter of fact, it would happen. And it happens today, every day. All men and all women who happen to function in the workforce, who have to keep up with the bills, who have to send their children to school in a world full of perverts and molesters and criminals. Those that have the demands of families, those that have the demands of taking care of the church, those that have the demands of schools. There's countless reasons to experience weariness. Everyone today is laden with burdens. The world doesn't call it like Isaiah did. It doesn't say grow faint and weary. They call it burnout. They call it anxiety. They call it stress. And all the young men and all the young women will experience this anxiety. They'll all experience this stress where they just feel that they can't go on anymore. Things are too deep. The hospital is full of people who collapsed under that pressure. The church is full of people that experience this pressure when they're forced to live in this world and society today that goes against what they believe. Now, the common thing for the world to do, they have prescribed solutions to this stress and this anxiety, this weariness, this burnout condition that they think they got themselves into or that they are in is a definite physical thing that happens to everyone. They prescribe alcohol, tranquilizers, meditation, drugs, violence, vacation. But all those things are temporary solutions. you take your tranquilizer, you take the alcohol, you blow up, you punch a hole in the wall, it may make you feel good for a while. But the temporary solution, a temporary relief for this anxiety, this stress, this burnout condition that you find yourself in. Now there is a cure prescribed in the Bible. It's prescribed by Paul to the Philippians. Let's turn over to Philippians 4th chapter, verses 6 and 7 is what I'm going to read. It starts out, "Be careful for nothing." Now, in our language today, that sounds a little strange. Be careful for nothing. Don't care about anything. But a better interpretation of this careful is full of care, having distracting care, anxious, anxiety. Be anxious for nothing. Have anxiety for nothing. Don't allow those things that cause you stress and burnout to come into your life and affect you and let them burn you out. Christ gave the same counsel when he went into the home of two sisters, Mary and Martha. He went in there to visit them, and Martha was busy bustling around the kitchen, trying to get things ready so she could serve Christ some refreshments to take care of him, make him comfortable. And she's bustling around in the kitchen, and Mary sits down at his feet and begins to talk to her. Well, Martha keeps bustling around. She keeps looking over at Mary, and she starts getting burned out. She starts getting stressed. She starts feeling the pressure on her. Here I'm doing all the work, and Mary's sitting down at the Lord's feet talking to him, and I have to do all this. Finally, she got fed up with it. She went over and asked Jesus. She said, "Well, you tell Mary to get up and help me. Can't you see I have to do all the work around here? I'm trying to get things ready for you, and she's just sitting here on the floor talking to you." And Jesus told her, he says, "Martha, Martha, you're careful or anxious about and troubled about many things." Then he told her, he says, "What Mary is doing is needful, and he's not going to take it away from her." It was needful for Mary to have the fellowship with the Lord, and he was not going to remove that from her. It was more important than the anxiety and the stress of getting a little food ready for him. Christ also told his apostles when he sent them out to labor, in Matthew, he says, "Take no thought." That also interprets to be not anxious. Have no anxiety. "Take no thought for your life or what you shall eat or what you shall wear." And then he explained, the birds out there, they don't reap, they don't plant, they don't have barns to collect food. They depend daily upon the Lord to provide, and he does provide for them. The nature of man is to prepare, to know ahead, to plan ahead, to make sure everything is going to go smooth and calm in the way it should go. It causes stress and it causes anxiety. And he was telling them, don't have this stress and anxiety. You don't see the birds out there with ulcers and stressed out on the limbs. They depend every day on God. And God provides. They're not burned out, they're not stressed, and they're not worried. Be not anxious for nothing. Be anxious for nothing. Be careful for nothing. That's not the end of the sentence. It doesn't leave it there. That'd be real easy for me to tell you guys. Okay, that's it. Don't let it bother you. Sit down. You go, "Well, that sounds real good, but gosh, you know, what's the solution to that?" It's easy to say, but hard to do. Let's continue with that verse. It says, "But in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known unto God." everything that you have to do in your life, take to God for that solution. Pray over everything in your life. The direction is given there on how you should pray, with supplication first. Take it to God with supplication. Supplication comes from the Greek word deesis. And if you don't know I'm pronouncing it wrong, correct me. I don't care. If you don't know, then you'll have to live with it. I'm not worried about it. Okay? It means petition your superior. Acknowledge that God is greater. Acknowledge that your nothingness, your dependency upon God. Give thanksgiving is the next step. Credit to God for what He has done for you. Thanks for all the things that He has already done for you. Then, let your request be known. Christ gave the example in the Lord's Prayer. Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth that is in heaven, on earth as it is in heaven. Then the request was made for the daily bread and so on and so forth. But he covered those points before he went into the request. He didn't just jump in, give me this, give me that. Help me through this, help me through that. Let's read Philippians 4:7. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Then the peace that surpasses all human understanding can be yours. It will keep or guard your hearts and your minds. Your friends that are stressed out, that are in the same condition and the same problems at work or life that you have, you'll not be able to understand the peace that you have within you if you pray and take your burdens to God as described here. Now, am I going to leave it at that? That's a pretty good solution to your stress. But I'm not going to leave it there because there's a lot more. You heard a lot more about it this morning, our prayer service. If you do that, you will have peace. But Christians, good Christians, oftentimes find it very hard to accept calamities, especially to other Christians. They can't understand how God would allow it to happen. They don't understand how an active minister might come down with a disease that will make him no longer able to function when he was doing a good job before. They can't understand how an elderly woman will fall down and break her hip when she's done nothing wrong and there's no need for it. They can't understand how they can pray for a healing, which seems to be good in their eyes, but it never seems to come. And these things seem to have a tendency to shake our faith, lessen our confidence and our trust in God. But in Ether, 5th chapter, 7th verse, it says, "For ye receive no witness until after the trial of your faith." There will be trials of your faith. Like this cited example, a story you can find in 2 Kings, 4th chapter. There was a woman who had a husband that died, and she had many outstanding debts that had to be paid. And she had two sons that were going to be sold into slavery to pay these debts, which was very common in those days. If you had a debt and you could not pay it, yourself or your family had to be sold to pay the debts off. This lady went to the prophet Elisha, and she explained to him that her husband was dead. She did not want to lose her sons, but they were going to be sold into slavery to pay off the debt that her husband had accumulated. And she wasn't able to work. It wasn't the way of the world at that time for women to work and earn money. So Elisha, he questioned her a bit and asked her, he says, "Do you have anything in the house of value?" She thought about it for a little bit and she says, "Well, My handmaiden has one pot of oil. Now, oil is kind of like gasoline and electricity to us. It was a necessity of life. Everyone had to have oil. They had to have it for cooking. They had to have it for light. They had to have it for medication. They used it for almost everything. It was a necessity. Every family had to have oil. And she had one pot of it. Elisha told her, he says, go out to your neighbors and collect vessels to pour this oil into. But when you go out, don't go out and collect a few, but collect not a few. Don't go out and collect a couple. Collect a lot of them. Now this was the trial of her faith. This is where the trial was going to come in. But she went out and she borrowed vessels. And she came back with the vessels. Rather than she decided to borrow. And Elisha and her went over and they started filling these vessels out of this pot with oil. And the oil kept pouring. And the oil kept pouring. And finally Elisha said, told her son, bring me another vessel. This one was getting filled up. The son said, there is no more. And at that point, the oil quit pouring from the pot. Now, she was able to go out and sell that oil, and it was sufficient to pay off her debts. It didn't make her rich, but she was able to pay her debts with the oil. The woman knew how much oil was in that pot when she left the house. And how many vessels it could fill, because she dealt with oil on a daily basis. So her faith was every vessel that she collected beyond the amount that she knew would be filled by that oil. The outpouring of God's mercy and love to her lasted to the extent of her faith until the last vessel that she collected. Whatever point it was that she says, I can't believe it, we ain't going to do any more than this, was the extent of her faith. Our vessels of faith often is another prayer, another day of patience, which is often hard, another try. It's something we failed at several times before. Forgiveness one more time. Additional trust in the Lord that His will be done. But so often we question God's methods. Why He did it anyhow. Reminds me of another story about a small boy in the Sunday school class. He was taught that day, he says, God created man in His own image. And the little boy looks at the Sunday school teacher and says, now why are some people ugly? How many of you said something like that in your life? God, if you would have loved me, you'd have made me good looking. God, if you loved me, you'd have made me smart. Those are the two that I said a lot of times to myself when I was a kid. And growing up, I started with, I wish I was good. I wish God would make me better looking. Then it started, why I wish God would make me smart. At least I'm like, when I've done something myself. But now, I can look back and realize, had God done either one of those for me, the goals that I had set for myself, I would not be here today with you. Had I been more successful, more smarter, or better looking, I had goals that would have taken me away from here. So it was God's purpose. You might ask yourself, God, why don't you give me more money? I'll be glad to pay tithing on it, God. God knows what's best for you. It's like a lump of clay sitting on the potter's wheel, complaining about how it's going to be made. The lump of clay has no rights. It's up to the potter to mold that clay the way he sees fit and sees best. God knows how much success, money, or talent that you need. He knows what point that success, money, talent will become a stumbling block to you. This attitude, this condition has happened, and it was documented so that you could read it personally. Let's turn to Helaman, 4th chapter, 49th verse, page 584 in the Book of Mormon. This is about the Lamanites and the Nephites that both been being driven down and robbed and killed and tortured and by the Gadian robbers for years and years. And finally, the Lord drove the robbers back. And the people had a good life for a while. And God gave them a good life. And it goes on to say in the 49th verse, it says, "Yea, and we may see at the very time when he doth prosperous people, yea, and increase their fields, their flocks, their herds, in gold and silver, and all manner of precious things of every kind and art, sparing their lives and delivering them out of the hands of the enemies, softening the hearts of their enemies, that they should not declare war against them, yea, and in fine, doing all things for the welfare and happiness of his people." Sounds real good so far. "Yea, then is the time that they do harden their hearts and do forget the Lord their God and do trample under the feet of the Holy One. Yea, and this because of their ease and their exceeding great prosperity. And thus we see that except the Lord does chasten his people with many afflictions, yea, except he does visit them with death and with terror and with famine and with all manner of pestilence, they will not remember him." Verse 54, "Yea, how quick to harden unto the words of evil one, and to set their hearts upon the vain things of the world. Yea, how quick to lift up in pride. Yea, how quick to boast and do all manners of which is iniquity." The Lord is not going to make everything rosy and perfect for us. If he did, give us riches and health and looks and had no problems, we would be quick to turn against him. But if we were strong enough not to turn against God because we had all those things, if the Lord came down and said, "Everyone that loves me and follows my commandments, I will make them good looking, I will give them smarts, I will give them talent, I will let them sing, I'm going to give them no problems whatsoever in this world, it's going to be a piece of cake. You got it made. All you got to do is love me." There wouldn't be room in this church. There'd be a line to sign up right now because everything would be given to him. How's God going to know who loves him and who's in it for the benefit if everything's given because you love God? There is a Dr. R.B. Goldberg, a cardiologist at the Harvard Medical School. And he did a study about the heart. And he came to find out that the heart does not beat like a metronome as it originally thought happened. Rather, its intervals between beats were different. They varied. And they went on to say it wasn't a random variance. They described the variance of it chaotic. The heart was chaotic. And they also said that the mind was chaotic. Now this is very much like life itself. There's chaos in your life. There's times in your life that things are going to be turned upside down. They are going to be different. They're going to be changing. Not in random, but just changing quickly, without notice. But why is life chaotic? Why is it chaotic for us? Why is it like it for us? The same reason your heart is. They went on to study and said the reason your heart has chaos in it says to be healthy. You need to be able to cope with environments that are throwing you curveballs. If you're wrapped up in some monotonous dynamic, you're in no shape to handle the environment. Your life is all you. If your life is all comfortable and easy going, you'll be in no shape to go out and confront the world. If the life that you live here is all comfortable, you wouldn't be able to handle the environment of the world. You'd have to sit here in church and listen to me nonstop. You have to have chaos. You have to have things occur in your life. Now let me make myself perfectly clear at this point, okay? Every problem, every bad thing, every burden that you have did not come from God as a trial of your faith. They may try your faith, and most likely will. That makes them no less of a burden, but they did not necessarily come from God. In the days of Jeremiah, there was a group of people. They became very corrupt. They lived for their own pleasures. They looked to satisfy themselves through possessions. They began telling themselves what they wanted to hear, and they found priests that would lie to them and tell them that there would be no judgment for their evil doings. But every time these people began using the term, the burden of the Lord, every time something went wrong in their life, they said it was the burden of the Lord. And as people would walk around with fairly good lives, the burden of the Lord, the burden of the Lord, the burden of the Lord. Finally, the Lord came to Jeremiah. The Lord says, I've heard that burden of the Lord one too many times, Jeremiah. He says, don't ever say the burden of the Lord again. I have not given these people any burdens. These people are so wicked I should destroy them, and they're saying the burden of the Lord, and I haven't given them any burdens. But if they say it again, or you say it again, I'm going to bring an everlasting reproach upon them. Well, by the time Jeremiah told him this, they threw him in a well full of mud, and he probably did have a burden of the Lord, but I don't think he said it. But they didn't want to hear it. But they wanted to blame all the problems on the burden of the Lord. But people bring these burdens often upon themselves. A lot of burdens come upon themselves. When Christ foretold his own death, Peter began to rebuke him. He said, this shall not happen to you, Lord. What did Christ say to him? He says, get behind me, Satan, for you're an offense unto me. Thou savorest not the things of God, but those of men. Christ knew what he had to do. What his goal was the will of God. These things that you have to do, these things that are your goals, these things are your goals that are not the will of God, but the things of man, often create your own burdens. They're not trials from God. If you remember the story of Job, he had a lot of trials, but none of them were his own doings. There was nothing that came because of his actions. They just came. They were trials from God. But when there are things that you have to do in your life to fulfill your own human goals, and they don't work out, they're not from God. Often you see people that just have to get married when they get out of high school, because everybody does it. Regardless of who it is, or if they think that God desires it or not. In fact, our brother Jay talked about being told by the Lord that he should get out of a relationship. Had he said, I have to marry this woman, and he ended up with an unhappy family life and frustrated, separated, it wasn't a trial from God. It was what he had to do, or what you have to do. If you have to go on vacation, and you end up with financial problems, or you can't pay your bills, or major emergencies that come up because you're saving for a vacation, it's not from God. It's what you have to do. If you have to obtain new possessions or a new car, and you find yourself overextended financially, which also leads to marital problems and attitude problems and health problems, according to the Consumer Credit Counseling Service, it was free seed that went up. The large majority of people that have problems financially are average of 33 years old. That's my age. Married with 1.7 children. I do have two children. And they make $28,000 a year, which is not poverty by any means, shape, or form. All it is they didn't use good judgment and they overextended themselves, and it's not a trial that the Lord put upon them. I'm not saying they're sinners for doing it. I'm saying you don't blame the Lord for it. Realize that you can create your own burdens. And because of your own burdens, often you find yourself weak in your faith, and you're vulnerable to sin. But you're free to act for yourself. And if you do find yourself vulnerable to sin and you act upon that, you find yourself falling farther and farther. Again, it's not a trial of your faith. It's not a burden of the Lord. It's a situation that you have to do. I like to just read in Helaman, 5th chapter, 85th verse, page 594. Kind of back up that statement. And now remember, my brethren, that whosoever perisheth unto himself, and whosoever doth iniquity doeth it unto himself. For behold, ye are free, ye are permitted to act for yourself. For behold, God hath given unto you a knowledge, and he hath made you free. He has made you free. Often, you hear attitudes expressed by teenagers. And it's shared by young people in their 20s, and 30s, and 40s, and 50s, and 80s. But they say they're resistant. You know, let me hear it from the young people, because this is the time that parents are trying to tell them one thing, and this is where it shows up. They're resistant to follow Christ. They say it would deprive them of a full life, keep them from being popular, restrict them. Then there's a statement. Everybody else does it. What are they saying there? And everybody else does it. Means they're afraid to be different. Anyone out there afraid to be different? I don't want to see your hand. If you're afraid to be different, if you're afraid to not go along with the crowd, a lot of people find themselves afraid to be different when they go along with the crowd. They do a few things that they know they shouldn't do, but they have to do it to go along with the crowd. So they do cocaine once or twice. And you know, there's a synthetic cocaine on the street. It was prepared by somebody and it was cooked wrong. And if you do the synthetic cocaine, just not to be different, one time, within seconds, you will find yourself sitting in a chair with your arms and your legs uncontrollably flopping and your head flopping, not being able to speak, and you'll be drooling all over yourself for the rest of your life. You are different. If you're on a baseball team and you're afraid to be different and you chew tobacco, which is the number one cause of lip cancer, so a couple of years ago the doctor had your lips removed, you are different. You smoke a little marijuana, your brain cells die, you can't finish school, and you can't get a job, and you end up in jail. You're different. Go to dirty movies and read dirty books, and you're frustrated and engaged in strange relationships, and you end up with AIDS, and nobody, your friends won't like you anymore after that. You're different. You have a few drinks. It's the number one cause of serious automobile accidents. You kill off a few of your friends, you end up in jail, or an alcoholic, you lose your car, you lose your driver's license, you're different. And those would be heavy burdens to bear. And those are just a few of them. Heavy burdens to go through the rest of your life. But they're not caused by God. They're caused because of man. Your own work, the things that you had to do, not be different. But you were afraid of the burden of being a Christian. You're afraid that that would be too hard, part of the burden to bear in front of your friends. Do you believe in Christ? I think you do. You're here. You believe in the words of Christ. But you couldn't. But if you couldn't follow him because you couldn't be different, you didn't want the load, the burden of being different in this world. If you believe in Christ, in Matthew 11th chapter, 28th to 30th verse, it says, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Those things that I described occur from the sins of the world and the things of the world. They're not light. They are hard. I've seen people experience them, and they are hard. But the yoke of Christ, he promised, is light. If you go and you're not worried about being different and follow the commandments, that yoke is light, and that burden is light. Now, ministers can counsel and teach and preach. God can come unto you in revelation and tell you things to do and not do. But there's always going to be some that have to rebel against the law through their stubbornness and resistance and their own wants to rebel against the law. The law to keep his commandments, the law to follow him and hearken to his voice. We're going to rebel against it because the law restricts. Restricts what they want to do. So what happens when you rebel? When I was coming up here to Colorado Union, I had to drive my truck nearly 600 miles. Now, there was lots of laws that applied. And there were just two of them. If I remember two laws, first law, the traffic law, drive on the right side of the roadway. And the second law, the physics law, says two solid objects can't occupy the same space at the same time. If I remember those two laws, it said, you know, I'm driving my car. I pay for this gas, my taxes pay for these streets, and these laws restrict me. And I don't want to do it. So I get in my truck and I head off down the road, and I drive it in a darn well freeze, all over the roadway. Both sides of the roadway. Well, about the same time I impacted the 18-wheeler semi truck from a grease spot on the roadway. I can't very well look up to God and say, "Gee, God, why did you give me this burden?" That wasn't a burden from God, was it? But we don't know the answer to that. We rebelled against the law. You come back to the faith. And it's going to trials. These trials that God may have given you, these burdens that you may have given yourself, if you don't give up, if you do survive them, if you can find a way out of them, they can benefit you. Through this chaos, like the heart, it strengthens. It helps you build character. It enables you to relate to others. It lets you help others. Your strength at that point can be a tool for God's service. Because you can relate to people who have only experienced the same things in the future. I'm not telling you to go out to create these burdens so you can relate later down the road. But we're all going to have burdens and trials in our lives that we create for ourselves. And if we can overcome them, it can be a tool to us. There is a story that I heard about a small girl whose mother died when she was very young. At an early age, she had an illness that left her almost completely blind. Her father was an alcoholic. He beat her. He eventually abandoned her. She lived in poverty without love or affection all her life. Eventually, she went to live with an uncle who was well off and had a nice home and had other kids. But this young girl, she was very bitter against her role, and rightfully so. She had a tough life. She's very angry and somewhat hard to control. And the family tried to overcome the problems that they were having with this young girl and help her out because they understood the life that she had. Well, it came Christmas time one year, and there was a rule in this house. The parlor where the Christmas tree was and the presents were was off limits for Christmas time. So they could wrap the tree and decorate it, they didn't be playing with the toys or anything on the air until Christmas time. And one night, this little girl snuck in to this room while they were asleep. And she walked into the room with a deep vision that she had for all of her life. She could see under the tree this little doll with a blue dress and long brown hair. The arms moved, and she walked to this doll and picked it up and began hugging it and loving it. And she loved it, this little doll. And she snuck back in there several times before Christmas. Played with the little doll that she loved very much. She couldn't wait for Christmas because she'd be able to have it with a doll all the time to take with her. Well, Christmas finally came and the parlor door was open. The little girl ran in there to find out the little doll was not for her. She became very upset. She lost all control. She destroyed the Christmas tree and all the ornaments and the other presents and ransacked the house and went to pull the tantrum and throw it out. She couldn't handle herself. At age 14, the family sent the little girl to an institute to control temper because they couldn't control her anymore. The little girl learned to overcome her temper. Learned to overcome her anger. Her name was Annie Sullivan. She went on to help another hostile and angry blind girl named Helen Keller. Annie Sullivan is known as a miracle worker. She founded the Perkins Institute for the Blind. The things that were her burden in life, she overcame. She used it to help. It became a strength unto her. Let's go back to my opening text in Isaiah 30:31. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They that wait for direction. They that wait for instruction. They that wait until the Lord delivers the strength to them to carry out his direction and instruction. They that wait upon from the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. And they shall run and not be weary. And they shall walk and not be faint. May the strength of God be with each of you.
And now it's time for our Heavenly Father, we're indeed thankful for this time sent before thee. We're thankful for the message that's been given to us this day. Asking that you help us that we might each place within our hearts and it might help our lives, that we might be able to live with our attention and our desires, and we might be able to live closer into thee and to thy ways. Yes, Lord, forgive us for our errors and we help us to overcome them and help us to live closer to the way that thou would have us to be. Yes, we have room for you to be with each one of us as we depart here, that thy spirit would protect us until we meet again. We do ask.